From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Cherie Gross with Fresh Air. Two teenagers, Leal and Jones and Lloyd Newman, produced an award-winning NPR autobiographical documentary called Ghetto Life 101. They did a second program about their neighbor, 5-year-old Eric Morris, who was thrown to his death from a 14-story window by boys aged 10 and 11. On today's Fresh Air, we'll hear excerpts of these programs and meet Jones, Newman, and NPR regular contributor David Isay. Isay trained the boys, gave them microphones, and produced the documentaries with them. The three have collaborated on a new book. And rock critic Ken Tucker reviews the new release by Sleater Kinney. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. Texas public safety officials say 29 people are known dead after a tornado destroyed the town of Jarrell yesterday. More than 24 more people are still missing in the region. A subdivision was leveled and 50 homes were destroyed. Geneva Simpson is a spokeswoman for the Williamson County Sheriff's Department. She says rescuers are still looking for victims.
We did shut down for a few hours last night to regroup, get a little rest, and it has started back this morning. We'll do intense search today before we start a cleanup at all. Right now, we're trying to keep everyone out of the area other than the research teams and the emergency personnel.
The twister was one of about half a dozen that swept through central Texas yesterday from Waco to Austin. The Air Force says a fighter pilot is missing after her attack jet crashed in Arizona last night. The Pentagon says Captain Amy Lynn Svoboda, chief of A-10 training in Davis-Monthan Air Force Base outside Tucson, is missing. Svoboda's A-10 went down on a training range last night where pilots practice bombing, shooting, and dogfighting skills. Searchers have found the plane's wreckage near the town of Gila Bend. There is no sign of Svoboda and no sign that she ejected. Closing arguments are underway for Jesse Temendequas, the convicted sex offender charged with raping and murdering 7-year-old Megan Kanka 3 years ago. Since Kanka's murder, many states have passed laws requiring community notification when a sex offender moves into a neighborhood. NPR's Melissa Block reports from Trenton.
Defense attorney Barbara Leppendorf tried to cast doubt on the 5 incriminating statements the defendant allegedly made to police, in which he allegedly confessed to strangling Megan with a belt, sexually assaulting and killing her before dumping her body in a park. If you accept the confessions as the absolute truth, Leppendorf said, I might as well sit down right now. She went on to list a series of what she called reasonable doubts raised in the case. Most important, she said, the, quote, so-called alibi of the defendant's 2 roommates, who she suggested were in the house where Megan died at the time she was killed. Leppendorf also pursued a different tack, stating that whoever killed Megan did not do so intentionally or purposely. If Temendequas is found guilty of intentional murder, he could be sentenced to death. At the Mercer County Courthouse in Trenton, I'm Melissa Block reporting.
Euthanasia advocate Dr. Jack Kevorkian is proceeding with his $10 million libel suit against the American Medical Association. Kevorkian's upset that the group called him a criminal and a killer in an AMA News release. The medical group had asked the judge to throw the case out since it was just expressing an opinion in a public debate, but the judge disagreed. Kevorkian's attorney says there is a difference between disagreeing with Kevorkian and calling him a criminal. The AMA plans to appeal. On Wall Street, the Dow's up a fraction at 7,384. Trading is heavy. This is NPR. In NPR's business update, the stock market has edged higher, extending yesterday's record. Bloomberg's Doug Krisner reports.
Investors are debating the outlook for interest rates after the day's economic news contained no surprises. Durable goods orders rose slightly more than expected during April. However, weekly retail sales declined. Computer-related shares are rallying for a second straight day. IBM is at an all-time high as its 2-for-1 stock split becomes effective. Nike has gained more than 10% on reports that billionaire investor Warren Buffett is taking a stake in the company. Among the active issues, both CUC International and HFS Inc. are lower after the two consumer services giants announced their $11 billion all-stock merger. I'm Doug Krisner.
Negotiators for the United States and the European Union have agreed to coordinate their standards for testing drugs and hundreds of other products. The agreement is a milestone that could affect billions of dollars in trade over five industries. These industries include telecommunications, medical devices, pharmaceuticals, information technology, and sports equipment. Trade Representative Charlene Barshefsky says the deal's a breakthrough. Officials say the agreement would increase U.S. exports by saving manufacturers by up to 10% of the cost of delivering U.S. exports to Europe. Semiconductor maker Intel says it's filed its own lawsuit against Digital Corporation, saying Digital has refused to return some confidential documents. The Intel suit is a response to Digital's surprise lawsuit against Intel earlier this month. Digital claims Intel's Pentium computer chips were built with stolen technology. I'm Corva Coleman in Washington.
Support for National Public Radio comes from this and other NPR member stations. Contributors include Wellington Management Company, providing investment advice to clients worldwide.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. My guests are two teenagers who've produced a couple of remarkable documentaries about what it's like to grow up African-American and poor in a Chicago housing project. Lee Allen Jones was 13 and Lloyd Newman was 14 when they produced the autobiographical documentary Ghetto Life 101, which was broadcast on NPR in 1993. 3 years later, in another NPR documentary, they reported on the murder of their neighbor, 5-year-old Eric Morse, who was thrown from a 14-story window by two other boys from the neighborhood who were 10 and 11. Both of these programs were produced with NPR regular contributor David Isay, who first conceived of the autobiographical documentary and chose Jones and Newman to do it. The three of them collaborated on a new book called Our America, Life and Death on the South Side of Chicago. Before we meet them, let's hear an excerpt of Ghetto Life 101. Here's Lee Allen Jones.
Compared to other people in this neighborhood, my grandma said she's had it easy.
I think I've been blessed because things could have been a whole lot worse than they have been.
But she has had her share of troubles, the kinds of things you see in every family around here. My grandmother had one son who was murdered. She has another son who's addicted to drugs and is in and out of jail. Her grandson, my cousin Jermaine, came down with leukemia when he was 6. He was cured, but the medication left him learning disabled. It upset his mother so much that she started drinking. Now he lives here with my grandmother, sleeps in a bed.
How old are you?
I'm 11. I'll be 12 this year.
What do you think about your mother?
She okay.
You love her?
Yeah. When she not drink, I love her. She start drinking, I don't.
Me, my mother, and my little sister all stay downstairs in the front room. I sleep on the couch. My mother and my sister sleep on a mattress on the floor. Even though my mother lives with us, my grandmother also has custody of me and my sisters because of my mother's mental illness. This is my mother, Tucci.
I've been on medication off and on since 1977.
She's okay now, but she's had a lot of problems in the past. It's upsetting to see her when she's sick.
One time, I had went downstairs, and it's a long story, but I started seeing shadows on the porch, on the back porch, when I used to look out the window at night. And it would look like Ronald Reagan, and he was talking to my grandmother. And I was hearing voices. And the voices told me to run, get butt naked. I had did that before, too, taking my clothes off.
What type of voice are these? Are they a man voice or a female voice or just voice?
It's just a regular little voice up there.
Who is my father?
Your father is a fella named Toby Flipper. He's saying you, he know you exist. He's saying you when you was about 2, and I ain't seen him since.
What do you think happened to him?
He probably did.
Thank you.
Okay.
Lloyd lives about 2 blocks from my house in the Otter B. Wells Projects. The Otter B's are made up of about 3,000 units. Most of them are low-rise houses. A lot of them are in miserable conditions.
Now we're walking in the Otter B. Wells, which is 50% houses are boarded up. Now we're going into my house. We're knocking on the door, kicking on the door.
I hope she hurry up and open it.
I walk into
my house.
Lord's house is kind of messed up. There's a lot of roaches creeping around. The toilet's been stopped up off and on for years. The place is always noisy. Lord's mother died 2 years ago from drinking. His father is also an alcoholic, so Lord's two older sisters have been bringing him up since then. Lord's sister Sophia was the closest to their mother.
How did you react to when you heard that she died?
I was very upset. I just thought my life wasn't worth living. I wanted that too. I just thought we wasn't gonna make it without her. But I see that we made it, and I'm very proud of us.
Do you think it's hard bringing us up at the age of 20?
Well, I'll be 20 this year. I'm 19. But sometimes you all give us a tough time, but I love having y'all as my brothers and sisters.
All together, there are 4 boys and 3 girls living in the house. Lori's sister is bringing them all up on a $500 a month welfare check. It isn't easy.
My name is Michael Murray.
His name is Chili Mack. He's at the liquor store.
Almost every day, Lori's father visits the house. His name is Michael Murray, but everyone calls him Chill.
They gave him that name. I used to shoot pool. I used to hustle. Any kind of way I can get some money.
When he comes over, he's almost always drunk. And the kids make fun of him. Like today, they asked him, can he spell food?
Spell food.
L-O-O-F.
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 Wait, what did you spell? We said spell food, what you eat.
Oh, food.
Yeah.
What you eat.
Yeah. Yeah, buddy boy, spell food.
L-O-O-F.
I asked my father, Chill, what his best memories of my mother are.
Man, I have fun putting our feet in the water together. We get sober then. Once you start getting high, the memory is gone. It's gone.
Why are you drinking?
I don't understand why I'm drinking.
Do you think you're going to stop?
Yeah, I'm going in rehab and take care of myself.
What do you drink?
I drink about 2 or 3 pints of wine a day. But it ain't helping me, it ain't doing but killing me. Do people understand it's destroying you?
If it's destroying you, why do you still drink it then?
That's why I got to go in the rehab program next week, because I don't want to destroy my family, because I want my family.
Do you think you've been a good father?
Yes, I have, to the best capability I could.
I have no further questions.
That's an excerpt of Ghetto Life 101, first broadcast on NPR in 1993. It's since been released on CD. I spoke with reporters Lee Allen Jones and Lloyd Newman from Chicago, while producer David Isay, who conceived the project, joined us from New York. Lee Allen, I'm wondering if, on this excerpt that we just heard, if you asked people in your family things that you never asked them before, like, who is my father and what do you think happened to him?
Well, I asked that question maybe once beforehand.
Did you learn anything you didn't know during that interview?
Not really. I mean, me and my mother had a nice relationship beforehand, and it was the same, basically.
Lord, you asked your father, why are you drinking? And do you think you will stop? Are those questions you had asked him before?
Yes, I asked him that plenty of times. And every time I asked him, I probably get bothered with me, but keep on asking him the same question. So it felt the same.
Lord, how did you feel when kids made fun of your drunk father?
It hurted me because what did you do telling my father about his drinking disability when your father is out here doing RERSA and your mother's out here doing RERSA, so what's going on with me and my family should be no concern to anyone.
David Isay, how did you start working with Lee Allen and Lloyd?
Well, I had been commissioned by the public radio station in Chicago, WBEZ, for a series they were doing to do a story about poverty. And I had just read Alex Kotlowitz's book, There Are No Children Here, and wanted to model something in spirit after his book. I had enough funding to do a week worth of recording, but I knew that I wanted to find young people living in the inner city and give them tape recorders and give them a chance to tell their own stories. So I sent out faxes and letters to junior high schools and grade schools and social service organizations, everybody I could think of, looking for young people, looking for atypically eloquent young people in growing up in fairly typical situations, and asking these organizations to have the kids call me, collect in New York kids who they thought were appropriate. And I got dozens and dozens of collect calls in my studio in New York. And one day I got a call from a man named Earl King, who runs an organization called No Dope Express, an anti-drug organization. And he said he had a young man he thought I might want to speak with. And he put Lee Allen on the telephone. And Lee Allen got on the phone and started talking. And he completely blew me away. He was funny. He was smart. He was introspective. A great young man. And I knew pretty quickly that he was the right person. And I asked him if he could find someone to pair himself with to do this project. It didn't matter if it was a brother, sister, friend, whoever. And he called me that night from a payphone in the Ida B. Wells with Lloyd and said, I have someone you might want to talk to. And he put Lloyd on the phone, and the two of them just seemed to have this chemistry. And I knew from the minute I heard the first tape that, you know, Lee Allen recorded on that first morning, that they were gonna do something that was really true.
What impressed you about that tape?
Lee Allen picked up. It was amazing. I mean, I was sitting. I would have the guys give me the tapes in the evening that they had recorded during the day. So it was that first evening, and Lee Allen just got up. I had trained them the night before. We spent an evening in Lee Allen's living room. I flew into Chicago. I got in late. It was like 10:30 at night, and I was up with them, and I trained them for a couple of hours with the tape recorders, and then they went to sleep. And Lee Allen got up the next morning, and he pressed play and record on the tape recorder, and he said, "This is Lee Allen, day one. I'm going to tell you the story of my life. This is my life." Yeah, you know, and he was. You know, having the dog bark and just doing it. He was a complete natural. Everything was just so real. And I just put on the tape and I pushed play and I just shook my head. I couldn't believe what he was doing, because it was so right.
My guests are David Isay, Lee Allen Jones, and Lloyd Newman. We'll talk more after a break. They've collaborated on the new book, Our America. This is Fresh Air. My guests are Lee Allen Jones, Lloyd Newman, and David Isay. They've collaborated on two NPR documentaries about growing up in a Chicago neighborhood dominated by housing projects. Now they've collaborated on a new book called Our America. I want to move to another part of the story that's included in your new book, Our America, and this is the story of the death of Eric Morse, who was a 5-year-old boy who was pushed out of, I think, what, a 14-story window by two other boys aged 10 and 11. In 1994, and this was in the Ida B. Wells housing projects in Chicago. And Lloyd, you live in those housing projects. Why don't you describe what the projects are like?
The projects is bad. You got babies raising babies. You got dirty kids walking around with their mama don't care about you. People begging. You got people snatching purses, change, robbing, sticking up. You got high-rise buildings, banded buildings, windows open. Everything that's wrong with a rail is packed up in one community.
What did everybody already know about the story when you started to make your documentary?
I believe that everybody knew that, I mean, it was candy was a factor in it.
Yeah, well, so, explain the story, because I'm not sure all of our listeners remember it that well.
It was that Eric and his brother, Derek, wouldn't steal candy for these two kids they went to school with. And Eric and Derek, I believe, told their mother. And their mother had went to the two kids' mother to try to get them to steal. And for revenge, the two kids took Eric and Derek to the 14th story and dangled Eric out of a window, out of a vacant apartment on the 14th floor in the Darrow Homes, which is an extension of the Ida B. Wells housing development. And after they dangled him one or two times, I think they pulled him back in. and then they dangled him out again. Then he fell 14 flights of stairs to his death.
You say 14 flights of stairs?
14 stories, 14 floors of building, yes.
What else did you want to know? I mean, people knew, like, the basics of the story, but you wanted to know more. What did you want to know?
I knew that, you know, something like that could happen, but I just really wanted to get inside the story. I wanted to find out the kids. I wanted to find out if they truly were vicious enough to do a crime like that. I wanted to find out about Eric. I wanted to find out about Derek. I wanted to find out about, I believe we wanted to find out about their lives and things like that. And I think we did that.
Did you know Eric Morris, the 5-year-old who was thrown out the window?
I didn't know Eric offhand, but I knew Eric's family. I know Eric's his aunt. I know Eric's sister. His sister goes to school with me. So I mean, I knew his family, but I didn't know Eric.
You spent a lot of time trying to find the family of one of the boys responsible for Eric's death, and you got a tip that they had moved in with a sister in a different housing project.
Yes.
So you went to that building to find the family of this boy, the boy who you call Johnny. You don't name the two boys who were convicted of killing Eric because they're juveniles, so you gave them pseudonyms for this piece. Anyway, so you went to the building to try to talk to the family, and I'm going to play an excerpt of that part of your documentary.
When you walked in the building, we saw an old friend hanging out at the security desk, Little Wade.
What's up, Little Wade?
What's up, Little Wade?
We thought nothing of it until we asked the security guard where we could find Johnny's sister.
You mind, Rankin?
That's my sister.
It is.
What's up, Wade?
Johnny, the 10-year-old killer, was our friend's little brother. Me and Little Wade used to play baseball together, and I remember the little boy he used to bring with him to the games, Johnny.
That's your little brother?
Yeah.
Man, what happened, man?
I don't know.
Little Wade took us up to his sister's apartment.
I'm Deanna Jones, National Public Radio.
Well, that's my brother, and I ain't talking about him. Go on, get out.
The rest of the family wouldn't talk to us, so we interviewed Little Wade outside his apartment.
Talked to him in the crowded hallway in the project with about 6 little kids around, man. That's why it's so noisy. Who's he?
My nephew.
How old are you?
5. Oh, 6.
What's your name?
Emmanuel.
What grade you in?
Kindergarten.
Kindergarten. You miss your uncle?
Yeah.
I miss he's nothing with his uncle.
No, I don't.
He do. Stop that, man.
The kids ran up and down the hallway, and we talked a little bit about his brother, Johnny.
You know, what were some fun things that you remember about your little brother?
He used to help me fight. I used to help him fight. Do everything with each other and stuff.
Do you ever shed tears about your little brother?
No.
Why not?
Because I just get that off my mind.
You just gonna keep living your life.
Yeah.
Sister just said she doesn't want Johnny in her apartment, so y'all have to leave her apartment.
Johnny's sister called Nation of Islam security on us.
So we wrapped up the interview and walked out.
I always knew when I started this story I was going to know some of the faces involved, but I didn't expect this. I couldn't believe I actually knew this little boy who committed the murder. Just a shy, scrawny, light-skinned boy. No different than any other kid in the neighborhood. Just exposed to too much, too young. And he exploded.
It's closer than I imagined. It's closer than I goddamn imagined.
That's an excerpt of the documentary Remorse, the 14 Stories of Eric Morse, produced by my guests Lee Allen Jones, Lloyd Newman, and David Isay. And they've also collaborated on a new book called Our America, Life and Death on the South Side of Chicago. Lee Allen, how did it change the story for you when you realized that one of the killers here was your friend's little brother?
When we walked in the building and I saw him, I was like, because I'm not a person who really believes in coincidence, and I saw him there, I was like, oh, man. I didn't want to really believe that, but yet when I saw him when we first walked in the building, I was like, oh, man. And after I talked to him and he said that was his little brother, you saw the reaction that I had. I mean, it was like, it came true that we were closer than we'd ever imagined. And I think it was a little bit closer. So after I saw him, it was totally, I mean, kids who you thought would prosper a little bit had, you know, sort of fail. And not sort of fail, they both failed because Johnny's little brother that's mentioned in the piece, he was convicted of raping, I think, a 5 or 6-year-old little girl. And, you know, kids who you thought couldn't make it because he had good baseball talent. We played baseball together. Even though we played Pee Wee League together, and I played Little League because I could play with the big boys. And after I saw him, and I knew what type of kid he was, to see him and know that him and his little brother, it hurt me. And it's still kind of shocking for me today, but some things you just have to live on with.
So you felt that these kids were kids who could have gone either way.
Exactly, and I thought that, I mean, I guess the environment was the deciding factor in them making it and them not making it.
You know, it's interesting to me, a lot of people around the country were saying, what kind of monsters could have done something like this? And it turns out, well, they weren't exactly monsters. They were guys from the neighborhood who you knew. I mean, you knew them.
Exactly. I don't what type of monsters would put them in an environment like that? What type of monster would put them in an environment where their swings are not there, where, you know, there's not grass, there's dirty, there's just dirt patches? What type of monster would put them in homes where, you know, toilets aren't working, where roaches run rampant? What type of monsters would put them in where, you know, garbage cans, the stink of garbage is in the air? What type of monsters would put them in that environment? Then you see what type of monsters can be created if they are so monsters.
When you first started doing radio documentaries, you were, I think, 12 and 13. Do I have that right?
Yes.
In what, eighth grade?
Yes.
Where are you now? How old are you? Where are you in school?
Creature Commons, Junior, 41st Lake Park, Chicago.
I'm 18 years of age right now. I'm a senior at Martin Luther King High School. I'll be graduating June 7th. I'll be attending Florida State University, where I'll be majoring in criminology and minoring in linguistics, and I'm going to try to walk on playing football.
Wow. So criminology, why did you choose criminology?
Criminology, I believe, it has a broad aspect of things. It deals with the philosophy, it deals with history, and it deals with mankind and to learn the origin of mankind. So I wanted to deal with something that was broad-based. And the major I want to minor in linguistics is because I see myself traveling a lot over the world, and I want to be able to speak in the dialects and the tongues of everybody in the world.
Is your interest in criminology in part because you've been exposed to a lot of crime growing up?
And it might, in such a way, it might, you know, take me to the reason why. I think I know the reason why there's crime. I just want to see if that's what they're teaching, or if that's the ramifications that they use in teaching it. I think I know the elements of crime and why people do them. I just want to see if it's just condensed to my environment, or is it worldwide, and why it's like that.
Lee Ellen Jones, Lloyd Newman, and David Isay collaborated on two NPR documentaries about life in Chicago's inner city, and they collaborated on the new book, Our America. They'll be back with us in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime, 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Barnes & Noble, bookseller since 1873, and by the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our discussion with Lee Ellen Jones and Lloyd Newman. And radio producer David Isay, who trained them and produced them, tells us about some of his other radio projects. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews Dig Me Out by Sleater-Kinney.
Thank you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Lee Allen Jones, Lloyd Newman, and David Isay. Jones and Newman are two teenagers who reported on life in Chicago's inner city in two award-winning NPR documentaries. They worked with NPR regular contributor David Isay, who conceived the first program, trained Jones and Newman, and produced both documentaries with them. Now the three have collaborated on the new book, Our America. Lloyd Newman lives in the Ida B. Wells housing project. Lee Allen Jones lives around the corner from the project. Lee Allen, Lloyd, how important is it to each of you to try to get out of the neighborhood?
It's very important to me because I've been in there all my life, and I think it's time for me to make a change and move on and look forward to other things.
What do you think is the best way out?
Stay in school.
I think it's much more than staying in school. I believe you have to be... I mean, because school, the times can become very boring. Because it's not a lot to do. If you're not a star athlete or a big-time drug dealer, you sometimes don't see the ways out. Therefore, you need somebody to motivate you. You need somebody that's at where you want to be. Like, you need to have someone. Like, if you want to be a businessman, it should be great that somebody you know in business, so they can help you along that road. Because walking this path of the ghetto and walking this path of poverty, this path of violence, if you don't have anything to look at as far as where the road is going to end and where you want to be at, then it's going to be hard walking it because there are so many temptations. There's so many things that will distray you on your walk. So, I mean, you know, to say, you know, stay in school and don't do drugs is one thing, but yet, I mean, it's a lot more temptations out there than that.
So you're going to Florida State University in September?
Yeah, and I should be there in August.
So do you think that that's going to kind of guarantee that you'll get out of the neighborhood?
I don't know, because I'm not so sure that I want to get out, because I believe that all too often when people become successful in environments like that, they tend to leave and never come back. And they tend to, it sort of robs the community because that, like I said, when you want to walk that path or that road, that, you know, you want to see somebody there at where you want to be. I want to be that type of person where kids can look at me and say, that's where I want to be, instead of not being there. I mean, if more people went back to the environments in which they came and showed kids, you know, alternative routes, then I believe there will be a lot more success stories. But it seems as though people get out of the situation, but yet don't want to come back to the situation, A, because they don't want, like Lloyd said, they've lived all their life and they don't feel that they can contribute anymore. Or, you know, B, they just don't like to, you know, look at life as they used to look at it before. I mean, but me, I'm more so on about helping people and, you know, giving my all back. I mean, because, like, me and Lloyd are a generation of our own. There's another generation behind us, and someone has to ensure their future.
Lee Allen, you said it's really important to know people who you can look up to, kind of as role models.
Exactly.
Who's that in your life?
I would say, when I was very young, my grandfather. There's no one that I looked at more keenly than him. He was first of all, he was a grown man, and I knew that, first of all, that's where I wanted to be when I got older, at least be a grown man. And he was an independent man. He worked for CTA. He worked for CTA for many years.
So Chicago Transit Authority.
Yes, he worked for Chicago Transit Authority many years, and he drove the bus, and he had quite a big success. And, like, he traveled. I saw him get his paychecks. He had his own money. He was a church-going man. He was a family man. And by me looking at him in that manner, I said that if I wanted any type of prosperity in life, that, you know, I would have to do something on those lines. So he was my role model.
Who else?
I would say that I don't really look at other people in the media as role models. I knew that I was as a child, I was more so independent. I looked at myself. I didn't really look at other people and say, well, you know, that's where I want to be. I looked at other men, and this is how I looked at people. I looked at maybe the people on the street corner and said, you know, they were like role models, but in a different way. I looked at them and said, that's what I don't want to do. Then I looked at other people and I said, you know, this is where they went wrong at. So therefore, I learned off people's mistakes. That's why I looked at role models. I looked at people and look at where they fail. And I said, you know, when that time comes to me, I'm not going to fall there. My grandfather was my really bona fide role model. So that's who I wanted to be like.
But I wonder if you ever feel that there was pressure on you to sell drugs or to do drugs or to steal, to do the things that could get you into a lot of trouble and ruin your life and make you like the guys on the street corner who you didn't want to become.
The peer pressure was great because after my grandfather had suffered, I think, 2 strokes, I believe, and he wasn't working, and the money wasn't coming in like it used to. And we didn't have it made, but we had it decently. I mean, we had, you know, a decent pair of shoes to wear every morning and decent clothes. After he stopped working, I mean, it wasn't there anymore. We went from wearing Nikes to Pro Wings, and that was something that, I mean, I could accept, but yet going to school, the kids couldn't accept me like that. And it was sort of, you know, their mothers could provide for them maybe a little bit better with what they had. And it was sort of, you know, pressure me because I wanted that. I wanted to have the Michael Jordan gym shoes. I wanted to have the Nike outfits. But yet we couldn't afford them, and so I couldn't have them. And I think that made me more strong, because that made me more independent. I mean, in school, you any day you would find me and Lloyd being by ourselves because we really weren't accepted in any group. And yet, I'm glad of that because not a lot of, I mean, we're probably, I don't think we're probably, but yet it's only probably at least 10 to 12 people out of our 8th grade class that's really making things happen. It'll probably be graduating in June, and it'll probably be going to college. So I'm kind of glad that I wasn't accepted then, because if I would have, then it would probably just been another temptation and taking me off my path.
Lord, do you feel like you've had role models in your life, people to look up to?
Yes, I was looking up to my father when I was much younger until he really started drinking. Because he kept me doing something like we used to laundry bags or do anything. He didn't have a regular job; he worked with himself doing his own business. So, I really kept myself with a job. So, I looked it up to school and my father really, and my sisters. I looked up to them ever since that I was out of 8th grade. Showed me the right paths that I needed to take. But so my sisters they were like 18 when they were raising me. That's after my mother passed and my father had started drinking. So they was younger then. And I knew that they would have to be strong to help me out.
Liel, now that you're headed toward college, is that something that your friends or like the people in your school are really proud of? Or is that something that they're trying to put down?
Anytime I've had someone tell me this at prom Friday night, which really touched me. This guy, you know, we're the same age, and he says, you know, this is really good, man. You about to make it up out of this, man. You about to do something. And I'm looking at it. He's saying, you know, it's good that you're going to make it up out of here. And I looked at him. I said, now, if he's telling me I'm going to make it up out of here, then that means he's still going to be in there. So that makes me fight a little bit harder. When I found out that I got accepted to college and I was going to be able to go to college, the first thing that stuck in my mind was the movie Boys in the Hood. Because I remember when I was younger and I said, you know, I want to go to college and I probably will. But yet, I mean, when I saw that guy Ricky who had a scholarship to USC in that movie, and he got shot. And when I found out I was going to college, I said, oh, man. I said, now I got to live the rest of my 6 months really, I don't know about, I said, not living scared, but just having to be aware. And I just told myself now, I said, like I told you earlier, I said, I don't believe in coincidence, I believe in divine order. If it's in divine order that I be shot or I be killed or whatever that happens to me, and I don't go to college, then it was in that fashion, it must have happened. I mean, so I stopped living in fear when I found out I was going to college.
In the 1993 documentary, Lloyd, your father was drinking a lot, and I wonder if he's still drinking and how his health is.
He stopped drinking for about a month, but I don't know how that will turn out because he does it off and on. But since he's been stopped drinking, he's been doing fine.
So it's been about a month that he's not been drinking?
Yes.
Well, that's good. Liel, how has your family changed since 1993 when you did get a Life 101?
I would guess that I think I might have sort of challenged my family because the success that I gained off of Ghetto Life, it sort of challenged maybe my sister to get up off her butt and do some things. She started working, and I mean, she got her GED, and she was working at Ameritech recently for about a week or two as, I think, a helper or something like that. I don't know if they've called her back to work full time yet. And I'm just, you know, basically I'm trying to help my family. I'm trying to, with the few connections that I've gained off doing this work, I'm trying to help them out as far as getting jobs and employment. Because I'm not one to, you know, sit here and brag on what I can do and what I've obtained if I can help someone else get the same thing. or reach a certain, or help them do something in their lives.
Well, Lloyd and Leellen, I want to thank you very much for talking with us. I want to stick around with David for a few minutes and talk with him a little bit about some of the other pieces that he's done. So, Lloyd and Leellen, thank you very much, and congratulations on the new book.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Leellen Jones and Lloyd Newman collaborated with David Isay on the new book, Our America. This is Fresh Air. Back with radio producer David Isay. He's a regular contributor to NPR. His first book has just come out in paperback. It's called Holding On, Dreamers, Visionaries, Eccentrics, and Other American Heroes. David Isay, in your pieces over the years for NPR, you've done a lot of pieces on people who are eccentrics, obsessives. You did a wonderful documentary on life in prison. And I'm wondering if you see yourself as having a specific focus, or how you would define what you gravitate toward as a journalist?
Yeah, well, I think what I'm interested in documenting are people who are kind of on the fringes of society, but finding the poetry and the beauty in their stories, and that's what I mean. It is a wide range of stuff that I've done over the years, but I guess that's what I've thought about this, and I guess that's what pulls it all together. It's about finding poetry in places you wouldn't expect it, and I think that this piece falls squarely in that category. And you know, the pieces I did for, that became this book, Holding On, about dreamers, eccentrics, visionaries around the country, falls into that category. It's about using this medium, which is so introspective and lyrical, to let people tell their stories.
What do you think it is about radio that lends itself to the introspective and the lyrical?
Well, it's a very intimate medium, and there's something about just being with a tape recorder and not having to worry about how you look. It's very unobtrusive that lets people talk. There's also a lot of freedom with editing. So it's about language, and you have these wonderful voices combined with these beautiful words, and it creates this atmosphere which lends itself to this sort of story.
Your previous book, Holding On, featured your profiles of dreamers, visionaries, eccentrics, and other American heroes, as you put it in the title. And you know what I find is that sometimes eccentrics who are obsessive can actually be very disturbing. That it's... And which isn't to say it doesn't have lyricism in it, but I'm thinking, for instance, of the person who you profiled who had the longest diary in the world.
Right, right.
And you did a radio piece on him, too.
Right.
Really fascinating piece. This is a guy who wouldn't even allow himself to leave the house, basically, because he'd be forced to stop writing in his journal. if he did anything other than write in it. And, I mean, it's very interesting, very obsessive, but it's really a very disturbing. Disturbing about it.
Sure, it's disturbing. But you know, here's a guy who this is his creative vision that he's putting out into the universe. And when you meet this man, Robert Shields, who's an 80-year-old guy who's been keeping this diary now for, this is the 25th anniversary of his diary. I mean, the man's at peace with himself. I mean, this is what he wants to do, and you know. I guess the way I go in is who are we to judge? I mean, he seems comfortable with what he's doing, and he's excited that he gets some notoriety for it. So, I can't really judge him. It's what he wants to do. He says that if he didn't have this diary, he wouldn't have anything, and he loves it. He loves doing this. So there you go.
Let's hear an excerpt of your radio documentary on him.
5:45 to 6:15. I read more from the Oxford Dictionary quotations. I ate half a dozen large Archway sugar cookies while I drank 2 cups of milk.
In his diary, Robert Shields records everything he eats. He records his blood pressure and pulse at various times during the day, the temperature outside and in, every conversation he has, every piece of junk mail he receives. He sleeps no more than 2 hours at a time so that he can record his dreams. Robert Shields has also scotch-taped a variety of his life's keepsakes into this diary, for instance, samples of his nasal hair.
For DNA purposes, it might, in years to come, they might be able to figure out my genetics from having a physical artifact.
What is this in your diary?
Oh, whenever we purchase anything, like meat particularly, I peel the stickers off and put it in the diary, because then there's a record of how much we bought and what the price of it was. 8:35 to 40, I peel meat labels from McQuarrie to mount in the diary. Bacon is up 20 cents a pound. T-bones are terribly high. I bought them to feed Dave, I say, Sunday evening. I don't know if they will...
It is somewhat disconcerting to see the extent to which this task has taken over the life of Reverend Robert Shields, chaining him to his typewriter on this endless endeavor. Shields, it seems, is so busy documenting the insignificant minutiae of his life that he has become oblivious to everything else going on around him.
How does your family feel about this?
Never asked him.
What about leaving town?
I don't leave town. I haven't left town since 1985 to visit my brother in Tennessee. I don't like to be away overnight because it gets me behind. If I travel to Walla Walla to do shopping, it puts me behind in the diary. I have to take notes all the time and get back, and it takes almost a day to catch up with the notes. So I avoid going out. I avoid being away.
David, I say, how has Robert Shields' life changed by your documentary on him?
I think it's funny because he kept a diary of when I came to visit him, which was very bizarre. He keeps a diary of every 5 minutes of everything that happens in his life. And it's strange to see this, you know, an hour after we left, he transcribed everything that happened when we were there. And at the end of the diary, he wrote, "Maybe now the National Enquirer will do a story about me." And indeed, 2 weeks later, the National Enquirer did a story about him. But he's gotten, you know, he's had a lot of radio interviews and TV interviews. And, you know, I think he's been treated with a fair amount, you know, he's been treated respectfully. And his diary is, you know, going to be put in a library, and he's... And I think he enjoys it. He enjoys it a lot.
How did you get started in radio, and what was your very first piece?
Do you want the abridged version or the unabridged version? It's a long story. I started, it was 10 years ago. This is my 10th year anniversary in radio. And I was headed to medical school right out of college and knew that I didn't really want to do that. I deferred admission for a year and spent the year tutoring. And one day I was walking around, and I saw this really interesting looking storefront. It was and I went inside, and it was a 12-step shop, like a recovery, addiction recovery place, and they had all sorts of different tchotchkes having to do with, you know, 12 steps and keychains. But it was really well done. And I started talking to the proprietors. It was a Puerto Rican husband and wife. And we started talking, and eventually they took me to the back of the store, and they showed me this model of a museum that they were hoping to create. It was made out of tongue depressors and toothpicks, and it was this very intricate 8-story model of a museum of addiction that they were certain that they were going to create. And then they pulled out the floor plans, and they had planned out every exhibit on all 8 floors of this museum, and it was just this incredible project. And as we talked, it turned out that they were both HIV positive. And they were working to raise the $20 million to create this museum. And they had letters they had written to Donald Trump, and they had a notebook full of the letters that they got back from various rich people who they wrote to, which were form letters, but were your typical encouraging form letters. And they seemed to think that they were going to get the money to do this. And I was very moved by their story. And I went home, and I got out the Yellow Pages, and I started calling television stations to tell them about these two people. And everybody said, "Sounds great, thank you, no." And I called the newspapers, and then I called radio stations. And I'd never really listened to radio. I'd never heard public radio. And I started calling down the stations, and at one point I called WBAI, which is a community station here in New York. And everybody was telling me, "Sounds great, but no thanks, sounds great, but no thanks." And I called WBAI, and the news director there said, "It sounds great, but we don't have anybody who can do it. Why don't you do it yourself?" And I picked up a tape recorder and went and interviewed them. And as I was doing it and as I was putting the story together, you know, it was one of those epiphanies. I mean, I knew I had found the thing that I wanted to do. And I bought the story back, and it aired on WBAI that night. And it happened that someone from NPR was driving through New York, and he heard the story and picked it up, and it ran on All Things Considered, on the weekend, All Things Considered. And that was it. I mean, I knew I had found the thing that I wanted to do. And fortunately, you know, within a year and a half, I had gotten a grant from the Corporation for Public Broadcasting. So I was able to, you know, survive doing this. And I've been doing it ever since.
It's funny, you know, somebody gave you your stuff by saying, well, we're not going to do the story. Why don't you just go do it yourself?
Yeah.
And in a way, with Lee Allen Jones and Lloyd Newman, you gave them the chance to do a story themselves.
Yeah.
So I guess you really believe that a lot of people could really rise to the occasion and do a really good story if you just give them the means to do it.
Absolutely. And radio is a great medium to do that. And, you know, at some point I also became bored of hearing my voice on the radio, and more have kind of tried to, again, be the vehicle through which people can tell their stories, to give them tape recorders or, you know, walk with them. And I'm doing a project now where I'm working with writers, having them translate their nonfiction work into radio documentaries. I did something with Ren Weschler from The New Yorker on the Museum of Jurassic Technology, this amazing museum in Los Angeles last year. So absolutely. Radio is a great medium in that way. I mean, it's incredibly inexpensive. The equipment is very simple to use, and it's unexplored. I mean, there aren't really people doing this kind of work, too many people doing this kind of work. And it's really rewarding. It's a medium that has so much potential but is really terribly underutilized, the radio documentary.
Well, David Isay, I really want to thank you a lot for talking with us, and thanks for your work. We're just so terrific. Thank you.
Thanks for having us on.
David Isay is a producer who contributes regularly to NPR. He's the co-author of the new book, Our America, Life and Death on the South Side of Chicago. His first book, Holding On, Dreamers, Visionaries, Eccentrics, and Other American Heroes, has just been published in paperback. Coming up, Sleater Kinney's new CD. This is Fresh Air. Sleater Kinney is an American rock band formed in and named after a street intersection in Olympia, Washington. Their 1996 release, Call the Doctor, placed third in the Village Voice National Poll of Rock Critics. Ken Tucker says that Sleater Kinney's new CD deserves more than just rave reviews.
Kinney's lead singer is a woman named Corin Tucker. Her voice is pretty phenomenal. It's more than just a super strong punk rock influenced weapon. This is Sleater Kinney's third album, and where she used to tear through lyrics, Tucker now uses her standard tone, a sort of throaty, modulated shriek, to carry all sorts of moods and emotions, as it does on this remarkable song about the pleasures of making rock and roll called Words and Guitar.
Take the noise and my head.
There's a lot of exhilaration as well as fresh-blooded anger spurting out of various songs on Dig Me Out. This all-woman band came together as part of the Pacific Northwest's Riot Girl movement, which yielded women-led bands like Bikini Kill and Bratmobile, as well as Corin Tucker's previous, more doctrinaire group, Heavens to Betsy. In Sleater-Kinney, a steely punk feminism remains vital. It's never merely a pose or an image, but rather an essential part of their discussion with listeners, as in this song, Little Babies.
I'm the water, I'm the dishes, I'm the soul.
While Corin Tucker's voice remains the most immediately striking thing about Sleater-Kinney, there's a wiriness to the guitar playing of Carrie Brownstein that gives the music a tensile strength. And the drumming of Janet Weiss, the most recent member of the band, has given Sleater-Kinney a new rhythmic expansiveness that they take full advantage of on a playful tune like Dance Song 97. Think of a recent album with a more thorough mixture of joy, rage, and puzzlement than Dig Me Out. Corin Tucker said in a recent interview that she wants her band to be able to, quote, raise the hair on the back of a kid's neck. Well, I'm no kid, but they raise the hair on mine, and it feels really good.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Dig Me Out, the new CD from Sleater-Kinney. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Sallet, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Alan Tu and Monique Nazareth. Research assistance from Sarah Scher. Roberta Shurrock directs the show. I'm Terry Gross.
For tapes and transcripts of Fresh Air, please call toll-free anytime 1-888-NPR-NEWS.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.